Continuing with this article, The Land of the Free by H.L. Mencken. Speaking of Prince Gaetani, he writes, Prince Gaetani, again the interrupting the Italian ambassador to the United States, Prince Gaetani was naturally called upon to make a speech. He made one bitterly denouncing the opponents of fascismo among the American Italians and arguing that, quote, a certain Italian paper in New York, unquote, ought to be suppressed. The assembled apostles of human liberty knew that he meant Il Martello and applauded him heartily. That there was no law in the United States forbidding a newspaper to criticize a foreign government did not trouble them. They had been through the late war and knew what could be done. So did the Department of Justice, then still in command of the eminent Doherty, and the Post Office Department. Word was conveyed to Washington and then back to New York. On July 21st, the whole issue of Il Martello was held up in the mails. Tresca demanded to know why. The Post Office Department gave him no answer. He kept on denouncing the fascisti. 3 weeks later, on August 10th, he was suddenly arrested. The charge was that he had printed an article 3 months before attacking the Italian monarchy. No such crime, of course, is known to American law, but Tresca was nevertheless arrested. He got out on bail and kept on denouncing the fascisti. The charge was allowed to drop. On August 18th, the whole issue of Il Martello was held up because it contained an account of a raffle. Two other Italian papers, containing precisely the same account, went through the mails unmolested. On September 8th, it was held up because it contained a two-line advertisement of a book on birth control. On October 27th, it was held up because it printed an account of how the fascisti had forced an Italian woman to swallow an immense dose of castor oil. All the American newspapers printed the same story, but were not molested. On November 10th, it was held up because it printed a letter from a reader predicting that Mussolini would come to the same end as Rienzi, another failed Italian politician, or a previously failed Italian politician. Other papers had made the same prediction without challenge. On November 24th, it was held up for charging Mussolini with misappropriating funds. By the way, in the aforementioned miscellaneous archive show Uncle Sam and Il Duce, the fiscal malfeasance of Mussolini and his government is detailed in considerable length. Continuing. Meanwhile, Tresca kept on denouncing the fascisti, and the Italian ambassador, it may be safely presumed, kept on nursing the conviction that Il Martello ought to be suppressed. The war, unfortunately, was over, and so it was not easy to accomplish the business. Holding up the paper day after day, and subjecting it to heavy and arbitrary losses, this was apparently easy. But it was impossible under the law to suppress it altogether, and very difficult to get Tresca into jail and keep him there. Finally, however, juridic science solved the problem. The little two-line advertisement on September 8th, announcing a book in Italian on birth control, showed the way. Experienced witch hunters from the Department of Justice were rushed to New York. Tresca was indicted for advertising a means of preventing conception, and his trial was called in hot haste. He appeared before Goddard J. in the United States District Court on November 27th. The evidence showed some strange things. Tresca, it appeared, had actually never sent a single copy of the offending issue through the mails. The instant he heard that the post office had held it up, he withdrew it and reprinted a new issue without the two-line advertisement. It appeared, indeed, that other charges were mixed up with the complaint. One was that he had printed an article entitled, Down with the Monarchy, unquote. This was plainly not illegal, but the prosecution made much of it. Finally, the assistant district attorney offered to drop the whole case if Tresca would leave the country, i.e. go back to Italy where the fascisti could deal with him. He refused and was convicted. Judge Goddard sentenced him to a year and a day at Atlanta. This was an appallingly heavy sentence, the heaviest ever heard of. In nearly all previous federal cases, the culprit had been simply fined. In none of the state cases had a sentence of more than 6 months been inflicted, and the average for all of them was less than a month. There was no evidence that Tresca had ever seen the advertisement before it had got into his paper. On the contrary, it was shown that the man who brought it in and inserted it was one Vella, the paper's advertising agent. The actual advertiser was one Nieri, N-I-E-R-I, an Italian bookseller. He, too, was arrested and convicted. He got 4 months in jail. But Tresca, who was only constructively guilty, got a year and a day in Atlanta prison. And there he sits now, for the Circuit Court of Appeals has upheld his conviction. Such episodes, and they are by no means rare, despite the common superstition that Palmerism has been squeezed out of the Department of Justice and Burlesonism out of the post office, give the student of American history powerfully to think. What becomes of the old notion that the United States is a free country, that it is a refuge for the oppressed of other lands, that here they may voice their grievances and call for help? There was a time when such rebels against tyranny came here as a matter of course and were received with open arms. The name of Kossuth, K-O-S-S-U-T-H, is even in the school books. But what would happen to a Kossuth today if the Hungarian ambassador could convince Judge Gary and company that he ought to be in jail? Also, what becomes of the old notion that a peaceable man in the Great Republic should be unmolested, that the Polizei should not pursue and harass him day and night and try by dodge after dodge to get him into their clutches? The post office tackled Tresca at least 5 times before it finally fetched him. Every one of those times, it must be obvious, he was innocent of any wrongdoing, else he would have been railroaded to jail forthwith. It took 6 shots to bring him down, and then he was caught on a childish technicality. Every American editor who prints any reference to a book on birth control, even if it be a review denouncing it, is quite as guilty as he was, and perhaps even more guilty, and consider his punishment. The man who offered the book for sale got 4 months. Tresca, for merely printing 2 lines about it, got 1 year and a day. I attempt no long sermon on the text. It is eloquent enough of itself. The facts, so far as I know, are not disputed by anyone. There was a time when their publication would have caused an uproar. Today, they go almost unnoticed. The great agencies of Americanism will let Tresca rot in prison before they lift their hands to help him, just as they are letting his fellow Italians Sacco and Vanzetti rot in prison. The American Legion, though it still sweats and moans for human liberty, will not protest. On the contrary, it is more likely to pass a resolution urging that the WAP be kept behind the bars, but guilty or not guilty. The Sons of the Revolution will maintain a magnificent silence. Kiwanis and Rotary will not be heard from. So far, indeed, but 8 persons in all the United States have gone to Tresca's aid. 4 are Italian-American politicians. 1 is a liberal pastor. 2 are old and battle-scarred libertarians, already marked with the scars of 100 defeats. The 8th is La Sanger, the birth control agitator, herself an experienced goat of the new jurisprudence. No one else will take any interest in the case. And again, that article entitled The Land of the Free is from the Baltimore Evening Sun of January 12, 1925, authored by H.L. Mencken, and from the book The Impossible H.L. Mencken, edited by Marion Elizabeth Rogers, published by Anchor Books, New York City, in 1991. Well, that is obviously a frightening tale, and one that has more than a little relevance for today. I would cite, for example, the program of terror that, if not actively supported by elements of the American political and legal establishments, were certainly allowed to proceed forward against Haitian refugees in the United States who were critical of the U.S.-backed junta in Haiti. That's but the latest example of something that is certainly analogous in certain respects, perhaps not precisely so, but analogous nonetheless, to what happened to poor Carlo Tresca. Let's take a minute to sum up what we looked at in this H.L. Mencken article, The Land of the Free. We started out by looking at Carlo Tresca, the editor of a small Italian paper in New York, or the owner, I should say, called Il Martello. He had been very critical of Mussolini's fascisti in Italy, and it apparently struck a responsive chord among Italian Americans in New York. In July of 1923, Judge Elbert H. Gary, the chairman of the board of directors of U.S. Steel, was made an honorary fascist by the Italian fascist government of Mussolini. There was a dinner to honor him on that particular evening. One of the guests at that particular dinner was the Italian ambassador to the United States, Prince Gelesto, or Gelesto, G-E-L-E-S-T-O, Caetani. We should remember, as we saw in Uncle Sam and Il Duce, the aforementioned miscellaneous archive show, that major American corporations supported Mussolini not only because of his concept of the corporate state, which obviously was something they found to their liking, but also because American financial institutions provided the investment capital for Mussolini's Italy. There was corresponding journalistic sympathy and covering up for the inadequacies, and they were profound, of Mussolini's corporate state. We should note that in his speech at the dinner honoring Albert Gary and making him an honorary fascist, Prince Gaetani referred very directly, although perhaps not by name, to Il Martello and argued that it should be suppressed. He was heartily applauded. Shortly thereafter, a series of misfortunes, and that's really the wrong word, a series of repressive acts were conducted, and not only that, not only repressive, but escalatingly repressive acts were launched against Carlo Tresca and his paper Il Martello. On August 10th of 1923, he was arrested on the charge of having printed an article that criticized the Italian monarchy. Well, obviously, there's nothing illegal about that. Nonetheless, Carlo Tresca was arrested for that. The newspaper was held up because on August 18th because it contained an account of a raffle. Two other Italian papers containing exactly the same account were not held up. On September 8th of 1923, Carlo Tresca's Il Martello was held up because it contained a two-line advertisement for a book on birth control. I'll remember that because that was ultimately the charge that he was jailed on. On October 27th, the post office held up Il Martello because it printed an account of the fascists punishing an Italian woman by forcing her to swallow an immense dose of castor oil. This despite the fact that many other American newspapers carried the same account and were not similarly attacked or held up. And then on November 10th of 23, it was held up because it printed a letter from a reader predicting that Mussolini would come to the same end as another failed Italian politician, Rienzi. Other papers made the same predictions and were not subject to retribution. And on November 24th, Il Martello was held up for charging Mussolini with misappropriating funds. Well, Mussolini did misappropriate funds, as we saw in the aforementioned archive show, Uncle Sam and Il Duce. However, as George Seldes commented in his 1931 book, from which we borrowed, in the Uncle Sam and Il Duce program, in this time period, and to a certain extent still, one had to, quote, tell the truth and run. Actually, we use the book Can These Things Be? Another of Seldes's magnificent books was Tell the Truth and Run. But the sources used in Uncle Sam and Il Duce were George Seldes's Sawdust Caesar, his 1935 biography of Mussolini, and Can These Things Be? Published in 1931. We also quoted for a time from Mussolini's own book, The Corporate State, published in softcover by Vedecchi Publishers in 1937. Perhaps it was 38. I'd have to go back and check that. Or you can go back and check that directly from Uncle Sam and Il Duce. All of the repression that Il Martello was subjected to did not turn Carlo Tresca back. He kept on denouncing the fascisti, and so finally, the Justice Department indicted him for the advertisement, the two-line advertisement that for a book on contraception. I would also note that today, in 1995, 70 years after this H.L. Mencken article was printed, once again we are experiencing a war on reproductive rights in the United States. So, as William Faulkner said, the past is never dead and buried. It isn't even past. Note, too, that even though there was obviously nothing wrong with it, the Down with the Monarchy article that Carlo Tresca printed weighed very heavily in the ultimate decision by Judge Goddard to sentence him to a year and a day in a federal prison in Atlanta. I'm sure that was no picnic in 1925. I doubt it's a hell of a lot of fun today. Also note, too, that the person who actually placed that ad was Vela, the newspaper's, Il Martello's advertising agent. He got 4 months in jail. Nieri, an Italian bookseller who actually was the person who paid for the ad, was not convicted at all. Note also that Carlo Tresca went to prison without a great deal of public outcry. And again, I think this particular incident is something that we should note not only because of the similarity between what happened in 1925 and some things going on today. For example, the murders of Haitian critics of the recently deposed junta. Those have not been investigated properly in the United States. It appears unlikely that the Haitian junta could have committed those murders, or agents of the Haitian junta could have committed those murders without the knowledge of, at least the acquiescence of, some American officials. I'm not accusing most or even all of acquiescence in such a thing. But again, as we evaluate fascism, what it is, where it came from, who supported it, and what we have reason to expect in the future, I think the frightening degree to which Italian fascism and the political and corporate and legal interests that supported it in the United States were able to suppress Carlo Tresca and Il Martello is of great, great relevance. Now, I made reference to the archive shows. Those are a form of radio documentary that I've put together over the years in which printed sources are read on the air, literally extracted on the air, so the listeners can use the resulting tapes as an audio study resource.
Yes, and those are available from a tape duplication service, no longer Archives on Audio, which was handling the archive shows when this program was recorded in fall of 1995. The tape duplication service from which you can get the archive shows is called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, located at P.O. Box 1179. That's P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California. Capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. That's spitfire@ix.netcom.com. There's a list of and description of the tapes available from Spitfire on the KFJC, on the Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com. That's www.spitfirelist.com. That, by the way, is equipped with real audio, so you can listen to the half-hour segments going out to the stations that carry this program on that particular week, in that particular week. You can also, there's a backup set of data on the KFJC webpage, and you can access that. There was the Spitfire lists, price descriptions, etc. That's on the KFJC webpage at www.kfjc.org. That's www.kfjc.org. And people living outside of the KFJC signal radius can listen in on that same website to the One Step Beyond show, 7 to 10 p.m. Pacific time on Sunday night, and also 6 to 7 p.m. on Thursday night. So, without further ado, we're going to go directly to the next bit of archival material. That was Il Martello from the fall of 1995, one of the many For the Record segments. And what we're going to hear next is a miscellaneous archive show from, actually, let me give you the exact date, from October 2nd of 1988. It's called Japanese Fascism, Its History and Significance for Contemporary Americans. And as in order to fit in all of the material that we're going to be playing today, I've lopped off some of the introductions and summaries of the programs. You heard the summary in that Il Martello segment. Some of them are a little long for, in order to get all of the material in, even though we're going up to 10 o'clock tonight. So I've lopped off the intros and summaries for some of these programs, but all of the text, all of the material, all of the meat of the broadcast, so to speak, has been left in. We're going to go directly to the miscellaneous archive show from October 2nd of 1988, Japanese Fascism, Its History and Significance for Contemporary Americans. This segment is about 20, 25 minutes in length. Those of you who are taping, please get ready to do so. 3, 2, 1, here we go. First of all, concerning the rise of fascism in Japan, we're going to take a look very briefly at the overleaf in a book that describes in considerable detail the assassination program which systematically eliminated the responsible democratic political leadership in Japan and replaced it with fascists and militarists. The book we're going to borrow on very briefly now is called Government by Assassination. It's authored by Hugh Bias, B-Y-A-S, formerly the Tokyo correspondent for the New York Times. The book was published in hardcover, copyright 1942 by Alfred A. Knopf and Company in New York. And on the overleaf, there is a good summary of the book itself. The book itself is far too long for us to excerpt in the amount of time that we have this evening, so we're going to take a look at the overleaf, which provides a good, accurate summary of just what this book is about for the most part. Here is the truth about the patriotic murder societies, the army gangsters, the army's idea of Japan's destiny, and the strange role of the emperor. Basically, what this book, before I continue to read the overleaf, what this book describes is the assassination program which brought Japanese fascism to power. This was executed by the so-called patriotic societies, which in considerable measure were both religious organizations and, at a street level, organized crime syndicates.
The patriotic societies, notably the Black Dragon Society, headed up by Mitsuru Toyama, were the focus of a good portion of our discussion in Radio Free America program number 7, dealing with cults. These organizations, which again, at one level, were actually sort of religious in nature, at the street level, they functioned in a very practical way as organized crime syndicates, with all that implies, were functioning at the behest of the Japanese Imperial National Security Establishment as assassins and hommes de main. Continuing with the overleaf to Hugh Bias's book. In Japan, the army possesses a kind of autonomy which immunizes it from control by any other agency. Long ago, Mr. Bias saw that the intoxication of this immunity would lead to war, and so he spent many years ferreting out from the secretive Japanese how the militarists gained their fantastic power. His book, therefore, is to Japan what Rauschning's Revolution of Nihilism was to Germany. Starting from the grassroots of Japanese politics, it moves steadily toward the amazing disclosure of principles. At bottom, the Japanese army is closely allied with gangsterism. The so-called patriotic societies which do its dirty work are nothing more than leagues of murderers, blackmailers, and thieves. Bias shows how these terrorists made contact years ago with certain groups of appreciative younger officers, and how consequently, almost every civilian leader who curbed the army's power was assassinated. This, of course, has two haunting parallels. First of all, as we looked at in Radio Free America program number 10, the rise of fascism in Germany was paved by the assassination program of the so-called Freikorps, or the Black Reichswehr. Basically, underground German army organizations, the Reichswehr, the Einwohnerwehr, and the Zeitfreiwilligenverbande, collectively known as the Black Reichswehr, originally put together as formal extensions of the Reichswehr, the German army, which then survived illegally to function autonomously, as extensions of the will of the German General Staff, systematically assassinated the legitimate democratic leadership of Weimar Germany. People like Foreign Minister von Rathenau, Matthias Erzberger, Kurt Eisner, Gustav Landauer, Karl Gereis, and others, names that should have gone down in history, have been largely obscured because they were dispatched by the so-called Black Reichswehr. The most unnerving parallel is to contemporary America, where even as so-called progressives sit wringing their hands about the fact that we don't have any legitimate political leadership, and maybe we'll have to vote for the Peace and Freedom Party because they don't find Mike Dukakis doctrinaire enough. The fact of the matter is we don't have good leaders because they were all blown away in the 60s and 1970s. We no longer have people like John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and others because they were assassinated by the U.S. National Security Establishment. Tragically, even though this is a matter of public record, it is a public record that the American people have steadfastly refused to look at, to their own eventual demise, no doubt. Suffice it to say that assassination is endemic to the rise of fascism. It was in Japan, it was in Germany, and regrettably it is here in America. Now, the Japanese army and the patriotic societies, those religious/criminal organizations, in turn were acting at the behest of the dominant interests in Imperial Japan. Those dominant interests were known as the Zaibatsu, Zaibatsu. Those are the five giant family trusts which ran, for all practical purposes, all of Japan. We're going to take a look now at Japanese fascism, in particular its financial and industrial structure. We're going to take a look at what the Zaibatsu are, how they came to power in a sense, or how they wield their power. We're going to take a look at their connections with American capital, and we're going to take a look at Emperor Hirohito's involvement with the Zaibatsu. And for our information, we're going to rely on a fabulous book, one we've used in the past. That book is called Facts and Fascism. It was copyrighted in 1943, published in hardcover by In Fact Incorporated. The author is a man who is regarded widely as the dean of American investigative journalism. His name is George Seldes, S-E-L-D-E-S. By the way, Seldes' autobiography, Witness to a Century, is a currently available book for people who would like to find out more about him. Again, we've used this book many times in the past, and we are now going to rely on it for our discussion of the structure and evolution of Japanese fascism. Seldes writes in Facts and Fascism in a chapter called The Five Who Own Japan as follows. Fascism, as any study of Hitler Germany shows, has been built up as a system of super colossal robber barons, thanks largely to the international cartels of which IG Farben industry was the largest. Interrupting that, of course, is the giant German chemical trust, the German dyestuffs industry, which we've looked at many times in the past. Continuing, by the way, Uncle Sam and the Swastika and the first two Radio Free America shows go into IG Farben at great length. Continuing, nationally, all forms of fascism have flourished thanks to the aid the state has given them in maintaining monopolies or trusts. In every instance where businessmen subsidized a reactionary party, whether it was the Fiat works in Italy paying Mussolini, or a landed estate owner bribing a Romanian premier, the party and the most powerful few of the subsidizers have always engaged in forming national monopolies when they took over the rule of the country. Professor Brady, by the way, that's Professor Robert A. Brady, who's a specialist on the economics of fascism in Japan in particular. Professor Robert A. Brady is the only economist who has related the peak associations, or Spitzenverbände, as they were known in Germany, that is, the biggest trade associations, such as the NAM, that's National Association of Manufacturers, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, with the subsidization of fascist movements, and shown how business, whether or not it is officially on the throne, has in all countries become a political power, in fact, the ruling power behind the thrones of fascism. Repeating that sentence again. Professor Brady is the only economist who has related the peak associations, unquote, or Spitzenverbände, as they were known in Germany, that is, the biggest trade associations, such as the NAM and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, with the subsidization of fascist movements and shown how business, whether or not it is officially on the throne, has in all countries become a political power, in fact, the ruling power behind the thrones of fascism. In Japan, the peak associations, unquote, are dominated by the zaibatsu, or four ruling families, who are comparatively more rich, more powerful and richer than the 13 ruling families of America. Excuse me, there are only four zaibatsu. The fifth power here is the emperor. I was misinterpreting the title here. There are only four zaibatsu, and as we're going to see, they're names that should be very familiar to a contemporary American. Of the zaibatsu specifically, Seldes writes, Japan's financial oligarchy, wrote Anthony Jenkinson for the Institute of Pacific Relations, is composed of great family trusts known as zaibatsu. Its leading members are the houses of Mitsui, Mitsubishi, Sumitomo, and Yasuda. Between them, they own the greater part of industry, trade, banking, and shipping. By 1937, they controlled more than one-third of the total deposits in private banks, 70% of the deposits in all trust companies, and one-third of total foreign trade. By controlling the banks, they controlled the smaller credit institutions throughout the country, unquote. Again, the names of the four zaibatsu, in effect the fifth zaibatsu being Emperor Hirohito himself, as we shall see. The four zaibatsu are the houses of Mitsui, Mitsubishi, Sumitomo, and Yasuda. Continuing with Seldes' account. In 1937, the government brought all the leading employers and business confederations together in the Japanese League of Economic Organizations, which Professor Brady describes as a sort of private national defense council for business enterprise. He concludes, quote, It would be hard to imagine a much higher degree of policy-determining power than is indicated by the combination of the zaibatsu and its concentric cartel and federational machinery. The hierarchy of business control seems well-nigh complete, unquote. The government of Japan and the business interests of Japan are bound together, quote, from center to circumference, unquote. What is being accomplished is the gradual rounding out of a highly coordinated fascist type of totalitarian economy. Professor Brady points out the fact that it was because the old system of feudalism prevailed longer in Japan than elsewhere that, quote, the new Japanese totalitarianism has been easier to achieve than in any other major industrial capitalistic country, unquote. The feudal and patriarchal-minded hierarchies of business, unquote, and the political and military bureaucracies were identified and centralized. Government and business are more intermarried in Japan than anywhere else, much more so than in the ruling family of Goering, Hitler and company. But all in all, the fascist pattern is pretty much the same in all countries where wealth and power have taken over the military, economic, political rule. Professor Brady writes that in Japan, the elements, quote, are not greatly dissimilar to those noted for other totalitarian systems of the general fascist type, unquote. He lists, one, the Zaibatsu, the monopolistically oriented enterprises centered around them and the extensive network of trade associations, chambers of commerce, cartels, and similar bodies of which they are the acknowledged leaders constitute an elaborate, semi-legal hierarchy of graduated economic power. Two, the hierarchy works very closely with the civil and administrative bureaucracy of the state. This constitutes the Japanese version of National Socialism. Three, the military is becoming increasingly part and parcel of the same control pyramid. Four, and finally, the psychopathic ideological propaganda cement which holds the Kakutai, the K-O-K-U-T-A-I, corporate state amalgam together in the fused power of Shinto, the main religion, and Bushido, precepts of knighthood. That last sentence again, and by the way, I may know how to pronounce the Emperor of Japan's name really correctly, but some of these names may be wrong. I don't speak Japan, I've just seen that reference in some other books I have. Again, the last item. And this, by the way, should be related very directly to the article we read earlier concerning the impending death of Emperor Hirohito and its political significance for the possible resurgence of Japanese nationalism and fascism. And finally, the psychopathic ideological propaganda cement, which holds the Kokutai, a corporate state amalgam together in the fused power of Shinto, the main religion, and Bushido, precepts of knighthood. Next, we're going to take a look at Seldes' discussion not only of Emperor Hirohito's direct connections to the Zaibatsu, he being actually the main beneficiary of the Zaibatsu, but we're also going to take a look at the Zaibatsu's international connections, their connections to the international munitions cartels, and perhaps most significantly for our purposes, their connections to big American capital. Every Japanese gun, bullet, torpedo, ship, and airplane that has killed or wounded an American soldier, sailor, airman, or marine has meant actual cash money in the pocket of Emperor Hirohito. When the merchants of death, unquote, the armaments manufacturers who had a financial interest in waging previous wars and who still do in fascist dictatorships were exposed in 1934, it was found that Mitsui and Mitsubishi were the Japanese members of the cartel and that the reigning family was a large stockholder in both. Hirohito owns 3,800,000 acres of land with all the buildings on them, many being tenements from which he makes a rent. The total value when the yen was still 50 cents was estimated at 6,637,234,000 yen. The son of the sun goddess has also invested 300 million yen in the Bank of Japan, the South Manchuria Railroad, the Yokohama Specie Bank, Nippon Yusen Kaisha, the shipping line of the Mitsubishi firm, the Imperial Hotel of Tokyo, and the Mitsui and Mitsubishi Enterprises. Next here, Seldes goes on to discuss Japanese participation in the international munitions cartels. Those cartels were front and center in the Nye Committee hearings that were presided over by Alger Hiss, chief counsel to the Nye Committee, and which were inspired in considerable measure by a book called The Merchants of Death, which is undoubtedly the reference in which we saw in this earlier paragraph where, although he doesn't have Merchants of Death capitalized, he has it in quotes. The book is called The Merchants of Death. You can still find it. I've forgotten the author's name offhand. This book inspired to a considerable extent the Nye Committee, and Alger Hiss made a great deal of political hay by distributing this to people. What that book basically pointed out is that in considerable measure, the wars of this century and of the late 19th century have been spurred on by giant international munitions cartels, which have a profound influence in all of the countries on both sides of all of these wars, or all of this world's major wars in the last 100 years or so. Of the Japanese connections to the international munitions cartels, Seldes writes as follows. In the wave of disillusionment which swept over the world after the Treaty of Versailles and proved that the old march of the imperialists would be resumed and that all international idealism, Woodrow Wilson's for example, would be destroyed, many secrets were uncovered, and one of the most sensational was that concerning the international of blood, the cartels of the merchants of death, the armaments makers who made a profit on the guns, the shells, and the bullets. The manufacturing corporations in many instances were found linked to governments and to have arranged, even in wartime, for the continuance of their dividends and distribution of their profits. There were several hundred members of the cartels, but only 50 were powerful, And of these, the handful which influenced world events and formed the Harvey United Steel Company cartel, the Nobel Dynamite Trust, the various rifle, gunpowder, and similar cartels were Krupp in Germany, Vickers Armstrong in Britain, Schneider Creusot in France, Škoda in Austria-Hungary, Cerny Ansaldo in Italy, Mitsui in Japan, and the Bethlehem Steel Company and DuPont Empire in the United States. Charles M. Schwab's Bethlehem held 4,301 shares in the Harvey cartel. Albert Vickers was chairman. It should be noted here that just as American big business was found at the time of the First World War to be linked to Japanese big business through the Harvey cartel, Nobel International Trust and other It should be noted here that just as American big business was found at the time of the First World War to be linked to Japanese big business through the Harvey cartel, Nobel International Trust and other agencies, so just before the outbreak of the global war, World War II, it was discovered that the international of money was even stronger than ever. One of the links was the IG Farben industry, which Hitler and Goering controlled and which involved Standard Oil, Standard Drug, General Motors, and General Electric and other of our greater corporations. Interrupting, of course, again, the international cartel connections of American big business with that of Nazi Germany were the main focus of Uncle Sam and the Swastika, an archive show available from Archives on Audio, and also were gone into in considerable measure in Radio Free America shows 2, 1, and 2, and also were touched on in a big way in Radio Free America number 10. Resuming Seldes' account, and here he goes into the international cartel connections linking American big business with the Japanese Zaibatsu. Just as American big business was linked to Japan through the Harvey Combine, steel, the Nobel Dynamite Trust, munitions, and the other munitions cartels before the last war, so before the global war, or World War II, there were the usual international cartels in which both the U.S. and Japan shared with Germany, Italy, and other nations. In addition, according to the San Francisco journalist John Pittman, quote, among the owners of Japanese business are International General Electric, which operates plants through its subsidiary, Tokyo Shibaura, Westinghouse Electric International, associated with Mitsubishi Electric Manufacturing Company, Tidewater Associated Oil, handled by Mitsubishi, Libby Owens Ford, represented by the Nippon Plate Glass Company, Standard Oil, with a known direct investment of $5 million, exclusive of frozen credits and oil in storage, Ford and General Motors, with approximately $10 million sunk in Japan proper, Eastman Kodak, and Singer Sewing Machine, with big organizations in the Japanese Empire, United Engineering and Foundry Company, holding a large stake in Shibaura United Engineering Company. Besides these shares in the industry of Japan proper, American capital is heavily invested in Manchukuo and other exploitation companies of a Japanese origin scattered throughout the Far East. Bear in mind, too, that we're talking about 1943 when the dollar was worth many times what it's worth today. The point being here, obviously, that we have a similar situation in many respects to the kinds of international capital and cartel relations which pertain between the United States and Nazi Germany. The same capital relations applied to the relationships between American big business and the Zaibatsu in Japan.
You're listening to the KFJC Memorial Day weekend special, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, detailing the relationship between the fascist powers of Europe and the fascist powers of World War II, I should say, and American corporations. At the conclusion of the original Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast from May 23rd of 1980, my then co-host Mark Ortiz and I read a warning that James Stewart Martin, the author of All Honorable Men, gave to the world, and that is that he pointed out that not only were the industrialists and financiers in this country who had backed Hitler capable of seeing to it, as they already were, that fascism, or the forces that had brought fascism, would be put right back in power in Germany and make it a menace again. But they also, or James Stewart Martin, foresaw that the same thing might happen in the United States. His fear may very well have been sparked by an awareness of the 1934 coup attempt in which the same industrial and financial interests tried to bring fascism to the United States. What we're going to do now is to listen to a half hour from, it was actually excerpted from Radio Free America program number 10 from July of 1985. This is about the 1934 coup attempt, and in addition to my own voice, you'll also hear the voice of my former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. That last segment, by the way, was Japanese Fascism, Its Structure and Significance for Contemporary Americans from October 2nd of 1988. And the reading was from George Seldes' book, Facts and Fascism. We're going to go directly to the next excerpt, and this is about a half hour in length, actually a little more, about 32 minutes in length. And again, this is excerpted from Radio Free America program number 10, the first program of a four-part series detailing the evolution of American fascism. Those of you who are taping, please get ready to do so. 3, 2, 1, here we go.
Anyway, okay, back to something that Dave mentioned earlier, not too much earlier as a matter of fact, which is talking about General Motors and the DuPont family, the controlling interest of General Motors, and something that we have talked about at great length in the past but have not talked about too much tonight yet, and that is, of course, the connections and the sympathies between leading American industrialists, specifically leading American right-wing industrialists, and Hitler's Germany. And this is a subject, of course, that a great deal of time is put into, and if you were around at the end of May, you may have heard Uncle Sam and the Swastika, or you might have heard it the year before, because it's become sort of an annual tradition around Memorial Day, so that people realize some of the things that were going on behind their backs while American servicemen were fighting and dying in Europe and the Pacific. Anyway, one of the reasons that Uncle Sam the Swastika was put together in the first place is to talk about these kinds of connections, the sympathies, and in many cases the outright business dealings between American industrialists and Western European right-wing industrialists and Hitler's Germany. And this is a subject, of course, that a great deal of time is put into, and if you were around at the end of May, you may have heard Uncle Sam and the Swastika, or you might have heard it the year before, because it's become sort of an annual tradition around Memorial Day, so that people realize some of the things that were going on behind their backs while American servicemen were fighting and dying in Europe and the Pacific. Anyway, one of the reasons that Uncle Sam the Swastika was put together in the first place is to talk about these kinds of connections, the sympathies, and in many cases the outright business dealings between American industrialists and Western European industrialists and the fascists in Germany and secondarily Italy. Okay, now we're going to be reading several segments here from a book entitled Trading with the Enemy, by Charles Higham, H-I-G-H-A-M. And this book is copyright 1983 from Dell. This is a paperback edition. Now, also bear in mind that Charles Higham has written another rather good book that's just come out called American Swastika, which is in hardcover at this point. It is not out in softcover, I don't believe, yet. But is another fascinating book on this general vein. And both of them come highly recommended from Dave and myself. Okay, now, again, though, from Trading with the Enemy back to the subject of industrial cooperation with fascism, and in fact, downright industrial support for fascism in many cases. Reading from Higham's book. General Motors, under the control of the DuPont family of Delaware, played a part in collaboration comparable with Ford's General Aniline, General Aniline and Film had heavy investments in the company. Irene DuPont was the most imposing and powerful member of the clan. He was obsessed with Hitler's principles. He keenly followed the career of the future Führer in the 1920s, and on September 7, 1926, in a speech to the American Chemical Society, he advocated a race of supermen to be achieved by injecting special drugs into them in boyhood to make their characters to order. He insisted his men reach physical standards equivalent to that of a Marine and have blood as pure as that in the veins of the Vikings. Despite the fact that he had Jewish blood in his own veins, his anti-Semitism matched that of Hitler.
Interrupting the text, remember, that's 1926, folks, from Irene DuPont, the founder, of the main person in the DuPont family, one of the dominant families, but 1926...
Okay, between 1932 and 1939, bosses of General Motors poured $30 million into IG Farben plants with the excuse that the money could not be exported. IG Farben, for those of you who are not familiar, was the huge German chemical cartel that originally began as a combination of the various dyestuffs manufacturers in Germany. And because around the turn of the century, late 19th century, early 20th century, so much of the chemical industry was concerned with dyestuffs and their various byproducts and usages.